From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
The snarky looks, the furrowed brows, the rolling of the eyes from so many people on your panels, and you know it. You guys have made a business decision to be anti-Trump. Okay, the country
and you
can
guys
see
have
that.
Also made a decision. You've made a decision to be antagonistic towards the media, to lump us all together, to rally your followers, to think that we're bad people and attack us online.
All indications, Presidents Trump and Putin hit it off when they met. Almost immediately, they rolled up their sleeves and started making deals.
Donald Trump Jr. is not part of the administration, and so this is a massive nothing burger.
Paul Manafort, whether or not Don Jr. is part of the administration, Jared Kushner absolutely is, and Paul Manafort is well-versed in this.
Let me read this. It looks like this is the first email from Rob Goldstone.
Trump Jr.'s reply, if it's what you say, I love it.
What's it say?
Well, it says, I love it when a plan comes together.
You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us to talk about the week's news, and once again, quite a bit to talk about, with Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also, here's Max Reese. He's a political reporter for NBC Connecticut. Hello, Max.
Good morning, John.
And Susan Bigelow, columnist for ctnewsjunkie.com. Hello, Susan.
Good morning.
The story that the Trump campaign, and later, of course, the Trump White House has been telling that they've had no contact with Russian officials, that they didn't know about attempts by Russia to meddle in the election on their behalf, all basically came unraveled yesterday as reporting by the New York Times prompted Trump's eldest son, Don Jr., to release a series of emails between him and a music promoter who was trying to set up a meeting with a connected Russian lawyer who said she could help Trump's father beat Hillary Clinton. It's the latest in a string of events connecting Trump's inner circle with Russia, connections that, as we heard just now, conservatives say are part of the media's continued attack on the current administration. Boy, I'm not quite sure where to start with all this, Colin. It was interesting reading the emails, which Donald Trump praised his son for releasing, saying that he was being very transparent.
Yeah. Well, first of all, congratulations on a very good summary of a very complicated story. I think you hit all the high points and the low points. I don't really know where to begin either, other than to say that, you know, on the one hand, it looks as though there's almost a naivete factor here that, I mean, well, let me back up. Okay, so the rules of crisis management go something like this. Get your story out as fast as you possibly can. Don't say anything that could possibly be disproven easily later. And don't leave anything out that could come out later, because all of that tends to lengthen the news cycle. I don't know if you can apply that to this situation, partly because this situation has been going for a long time. I mean, they have one problem, which is that over and over again, from different sets of lips and teeth on the Trump administration and the Trump campaign, have come some version of no contact with the Russians, no campaign contact with the Russians. Now, you can parse those things and see if there's any little escape hatches and stuff, but the reality is that's been a very consistent message, no campaign contact with the Russians. Well, there is campaign contact with the Russians. It's significant. It didn't just involve, you know, a rookie like Donald Trump Jr. and involved a pro like Paul Manafort. So, I mean, they've been lying. You can start there. They've been lying. They've been caught in a lie. That's number one. Now, the other question is, what are the legal ramifications of this? It gets a lot more complicated, and there's still, despite all the transparency, there's still a lot that we don't know about that. However, as has been pointed out, if you could interpret the notion that that opposition research about your opponent is a thing of value, then it would appear that they were there for the purpose of receiving a thing of value from a foreign national. At that point, it doesn't matter whether she has a real connection to the Russian chief prosecutor or not. They're there to do that. And then probably the other major looming question is, what have these guys said already to federal investigators? You know, what if they've been questioned, if they've been questioned under oath, what have they said, and to what degree does that need to be amended? Because now we're sort of in what I would think of as Martha Stewart category territory, which is that, you know, you can get in a lot of trouble for lying to a federal. If you lie to an FBI investigator about an investigation, that's obstruction of justice.
Yeah, I think I heard Charles Krauthammer of all people saying, you know, if you set up a deal to receive stolen goods, and you show up there, and the goods aren't there, but the cops are there, you can't exactly say, hey, well, the deal didn't go through. Let's actually listen to Don Jr., which, I mean, crisis management, Colin. He decides he's going to get this stuff out in advance of the New York Times. I mean, the New York Times kind of prompted him to do this. But then he went on Sean Hannity last night to talk a bit about it.
In retrospect, I probably would have done things a little differently. Again, this is before the Russia mania. This is before they were building it up in the press. For me, this was opposition research.
Okay, so
could I just say, in all fairness, it turns out that was Will Arnett, and nobody noticed. It really wasn't Donald Trump Jr.
I probably would have done things differently. I mean, I think a thing that's interesting, Max, is that part of the argument that he is making on Hannity last night is this is before the Russia mania. This is before everyone's talking about the whole Russia thing. And I think what happens is it sidesteps this problem of was it the right thing to do to try to get opposition research from a foreign national?
Hey, I use this excuse all the time with my email inboxes. I can't help who sends me what they send me. I can't help what ends up there. You know, if my dad sends me 87 jokes that are completely inappropriate into my NBC inbox, sorry, wasn't me.
I would change that. I love it auto reply you have right now, because that turns out it's not a good thing.
LOL. No, it is. I mean, there are so the adjectives escape, right, for how you really describe what's gone on here. In black and white, we now have the Russian government saying at an early, or someone saying they were acting on behalf of the Russian government, more accurately, at a very early stage, June of last year, that the Russian government is trying to help Donald Trump. So now that throws new questions at people like Jeff Sessions. There were all these questions about Paul Manafort that Colin McEnroe just mentioned, and the pride of heart hitting New Britain, and now they were all denying it from moment one. And Don Jr. kind of comes out and goes, "Oh yeah, it's a thing that happened, but it wasn't really a big deal." And I don't know how the American people now are supposed to respond to this. By the way, I also wonder if parts of America even care, frankly. I still think that there's a good question about whether some of that Trump country, if you will, even right here in Connecticut, think this is still that drummed up conspiracy that the media, us in the media, are talking too much about it. But a foreign government can't meddle in another election. There's criminal activity involved with that. And
well, there's the what actually happened, Susan. There's the what do people care about what actually happened. There's the questions of, is there going to be any criminal prosecution in all this? I mean, I think the key members here that went to this meeting are Donald Trump Jr., who was a part of the Trump campaign but is not part of the Trump White House, and as Colin said earlier, kind of a political newcomer, let's just put it that way, and also a guy, Paul Manafort, who is not a political newcomer, but probably, let's just say, has taken meetings like this before.
But not in democracies. In fairness to Paul Manafort, he doesn't have a lot of recent experience with democracies.
So he usually shows up and talks to despotic leaders somewhere else around the world. But the third member of that team, Jared Kushner, is actually not just a part of the White House, but seems to be the most high-functioning member of the White House right now. He's involved in a lot of things. He's trying to broker Mideast peace. He's trying to do a lot of work on behalf of the White House, and seems as though he was in these meetings too.
It does. And in fact, that's how they found out about this stuff, is that his lawyers were going through, I think, all of his correspondence, and they discovered this meeting, and they had to amend his security clearance form to say, oh, this thing happened, because he had neglected, I suppose he just forgot. They forget a lot of stuff about Russia. I don't know what it is. But he did not put this down on his application for a security clearance. So this puts him, I think, in a lot of trouble. Because he was operating at a pretty high level in the campaign, he should have known better than to take this. Certainly Paul Manafort should have known not to take this. You can excuse Donald Jr. as kind of the Fredo of the family, that he doesn't know what he's doing, he's not very bright, okay, he's a newcomer. But these other people who are experienced operators, especially Paul Manafort, really should have known that this was a big no-no. So is there something that can be prosecuted here? Well, it does seem like there might be.
It's getting harder to figure out who the Fredo of the family is. They may just have the Fredo gene. But yeah, well, one story that I would suggest that people keep their eyes on, it's brand new, and I didn't really have time to master it before we went on the air. It's coming out of McClatchy, and it points to Kushner, and says that both House and Senate Intelligence Committee is looking into questions about whether Kushner's data operation might have coordinated with some of the fake news operations. In other words, one of the ways that if you want to establish heading into Election Day, if you want to root in people's minds the notion that Hillary Clinton had something to do with a pedophile sex ring at a pizza place in Washington, D.C., just blatting it out all over the internet isn't as effective as targeting. And so, I don't know, McClatchy feels like they've got something. It might be more smoke than it is fire, but if that's true, if Russian fake news or disinformation operations coordinated at all through Kushner with a Trump data operation, that would also lead you towards the conclusion of collusion. I ultimately think the political problem is bigger than the legal problem. I don't know. In the third year of the Trump presidency, Bob Mueller may be walking a whole lot of people out of there in handcuffs. But I don't think that's going to be happening this year. I don't think it's going to happen in time to affect the 2018 elections. Could be wrong. But the political consequences of this, even though they don't budge the Trump base that much, right? As we look at polling on the Trump voters, they see this stuff and they put it into some kind of pigeonhole. It just doesn't really change their opinion of him or who he is. He's a norm violator, and so there's some more norms that he violated. But, I mean, it's a general political problem and the approval rating somewhere in the 30s. Yeah, this is big.
Max?
We touched on a little bit earlier about the possible legal ramifications, no one here is an attorney, but in seeing a lot of the analysis, it looks like, kind of once again, we're seeing a political motive go right up to the toe, right up to the line of what is legal and what's not, is what it looks like. And I say that because, Colin raised the question earlier, is some opposition research really a thing of value? Is that something that involves a campaign? Did a Russian government really give something that involves campaign finance to a campaign? To the naked eye, I don't think that's precisely what happened here. And that's why, we may not see any kind of legal result on this for years, to Colin's point.
And there's the question of whether or not people are caring about this and whether or not people are actually paying attention. Yeah, I think it's huge too. But there's the question of, all right, what does the American people think about this? And certainly no. The Trump base, which is different from the Trump voters, it's a smaller subset. There's a base of people for Trump that will believe this is just a media witch hunt, but I think that there is a growing interest in this in the country, and it's not something that people are just tuning out.
I will just say, though, I think that one of the things that I saw on Twitter as everyone tries to opine in their own way on this came from a Democratic organizer who said that the goal now shouldn't be to take down Trump for Democrats. It should be to use Trump to take down the entire Republican Party, and that should be their goal. And I read that and I think to myself, the goal should be trying to figure out how we might govern a country in a way that works. We don't seem to have that right now, either in Washington or, as we'll say, in just a little bit in Connecticut. And I don't know, Colin, you and I have had years of conversations about this stuff, about how far opposition research can go and how much you can be really intent on damaging the other guy for political gain. I think that part of what is happening is that America believes that politics has become such a blood sport that they don't really care about stuff like this because this is what they do. And if that's the case, then there's maybe not a hole deep enough that we can dig that will go down to get to the bottom of all, not just this nastiness, but all the nastiness that happens around political campaigning.
John, that's so public radio. We ought to be governing. All right, so yeah, maybe the way to look at this is to back up and say that a lot of what we might be saying in terms of our reactions to all this presupposes a prior time in which there was widespread public respect for the way things that were done in Washington. And when I mean a prior time, I mean like 2014, that at that time, most Americans were pretty happy with and respectful of the way that Washington operated. Well, we know that not to be the case. And in many respects, the rise of Donald Trump and his contempt for existing norms and the process are closely tied together. And so now, I mean, the fact that he doesn't follow the rules and that his, you know, his family is some kind of, you know, weird mirror of the Corleones or whatever narrative you want to construct, it won't reach people who didn't think the system was any good before. I think the larger question, I mean, first of all, your question is a great one. Like, how do we come out of this with some sort of coalition that can actually govern? I saw an article just today suggesting that what would really be effective if some would be if some of the moderate Republicans would get together with some of the Democrats on health care and really craft something that worked. Maybe when this settles down a little bit, you might see something like that. But for now, I think you really do have a lot of people who – I think the biggest problem that Trump might have is that the unfortunate timing of this particular scandal, if that's the right word, with the optics of this past weekend in Hamburg. So, I mean, I think the public's willing to put up with a lot from Trump, at least the people who like Trump, that group, his core supporters. And then there's some kind of indifferent middle that just doesn't get too worked up about this stuff. You know, but that notion of what the public is willing to put up with from Putin is a separate question. I mean, if this is like some kind of co-presidency, that might actually be a problem.
Well look, we had a certainly not a Trump supporter, but a conservative member of the Connecticut media, Chris Powell, on the show not too long ago. And, you know, he was saying, you know, Russia does this, we do this, people do this. He didn't seem all that terribly concerned about Vladimir Putin. And that may be a feeling out there. Well, let me just pivot quickly, Max, to one thing we wanted to talk about before the break in all this. And Colin wrote about it this weekend, so I do want to get his take, too. But look, one of the things that we're most concerned about here in this room is the fact that Vladimir Putin is not seen as someone who is media averse or who doesn't like the media. He's someone who has been linked to the killing of journalists. The Committee to Protect Journalists has cited some 60 journalists killed in Russia since 1993, a lot of them covering politics, corruption, war. Some of them potentially linked to Vladimir Putin, many of them not. But the point of the matter is that when Vladimir Putin looks at a group of reporters and sort of makes a joke about them in front of Donald Trump, and that we're all supposed to sit back and take this, there is a fear of all the norms that Colin was just talking about that have seemingly been violated. One is that the press is something that's useful and good and that we're trying to do really good work by giving information out that people need to know.
A lot of the spillover of the negativity into the media, I don't think it's just come from Europe. I think a lot of it's kind of happened in a homegrown way here. I mean, Donald Trump would start campaign rallies. He started the campaign rally at Sacred Heart University. I'm standing on the riser, and he gets up on stage and he goes, "Look at those cameras. Look at those cameras. They're the worst human beings I've ever met in my life." When you say that about the press, the people who are covering you, there is something chilling about that. You can laugh it off the way a couple of us did up there because, you know, we're just doing our jobs. So people were booing. They didn't throw anything at us. But that was a theme throughout the campaign. And now here we are, and he's now the president. And there is still a vitriol that was in that clip this morning between Chris Cuomo and Kellyanne Conway talking about how the Trump team has just tried to completely discredit in almost too far terms, where they'll say, "Oh, that person's disgusting," or "That person's mean. They just hate us." I mean, I think it'd be hard pressed to find that many journalists who are saying, "How can I make X person's life miserable today?" Even though Vladimir Putin obviously thinks that anytime that his life was made difficult, he had to make it go away.
This also gets down to, I think, a fundamental question of sort of who we are as Americans and if we do actually have sort of a shared set of values. Because America doesn't have a shared nationality. We don't have shared ethnic history. Do we actually have a shared set of values? That's supposedly what makes holds our country together. Do we have a set of values that makes us believe in a free press? Do we believe in the fundamentals of our democracy? Do we believe that foreign nations should not interfere with them? And that's really being tested. And that's what worries me the most, is that we're going to come out of this. And the notion that America has, that one part of America has anything in common, any kind of shared values with another, might be completely blown up.
So, I wrote that piece partly because there was a time during the campaign, I can't pinpoint it anymore, I was watching him speak, it might have been his convention speech, I can't remember, where I thought this man would lock up a reporter just because of what the reporter wrote. Not a James Risen kind of case where there was national security classified materials involved, but just because he didn't like it. That is what happens all over the world. It doesn't happen here. And, I think Susan is right. We're back to that whole question of shared norms. Emily Bazelon, New Haven's own Emily Bazelon, wrote a piece about this for the New York Times recently, that every time Trump breaks a norm, we either accept it or we don't, but he breaks them so often that I think we tend to it just becomes a little bit more part of the new normal. And maybe at some point locking up a reporter because you didn't like what he wrote will become kind of a norm. I mean, obviously the courts will wind up having to deal with it. But I mean, in terms of what people understand, and I do feel as though that is accompanied by, I mean, I think physical violence and rhetorical violence are very closely linked. And so, yes, when Donald Trump tweeted that little sort of video of him body slamming and punching a figure, it was Vince McMahon, I think, but a figure with the CNN logo for a face, it very closely linked back to Gianforte, the candidate in Montana who body slammed a reporter who was asking a fairly innocuous question at the time. You know, so you want to talk about breaking a norm, making something a little bit more normal. The notion, you can go back to Corey Lewandowski during the campaign, who I think pulled a reporter to the ground. That notion that you could become violent with the press just because you're tired of having them around. You know, I mean, really, we are kind of turning up the temperature of the water on that.
Well, go ahead, Matt.
No, and taking that one step further, you can body slam a member of the press one day before your election and still win running away. That's where we've gotten.
That's the problem with early voting, though.
which it gets into an early voting conversation, which maybe we won't have right now. We got to take a break. When we come back, let's turn to state stuff, because at least here at the state level, everything's working just fine. We'll talk about the budget. We'll also talk about this Atlantic piece that questions what's wrong with Connecticut. This isn't the first piece like this recently. We're talking with Max Rees from NBC Connecticut, Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe here in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Susan Bigelow, a columnist for CTNewsJunkie.com, Max Rees, political reporter for NBC Connecticut, and our own Colin McEnroe. Colin, what is on your show today?
Today on our show, we are going to use a little bit of the excitement around the James Baldwin documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, and a couple of books that intrigued us to talk about basically what it's like in 2017 to be black in America and why, despite some overall belief that things have gotten better, a lot of things kind of haven't.
That's coming up today, 1 o'clock, on the Colin McEnroe Show. Hope you can join us. Connecticut is currently operating under an executive order without a budget agreement. It seems like one isn't even close. All four caucuses, House Democrats and Republicans, Senate Democrats and Republicans, have different ideas about what to do, or maybe no ideas at all. We'll see. The GOP House put out a plan this week that Keith Faniff from the Connecticut Mirror reports relies on $2 billion in labor savings mandated by statutory changes and not bargained collectively. We'll see how that plays with the Democrats. Max, you're up there a lot, so why don't you tell us, where are we right now with the budget?
So it's so funny. A lot of things have happened, yet nothing has happened at the same time. It's very zen what's going on
up there. It's a nothing burger.
Yeah, it's a nothing burger. So yesterday, House Republicans provided their presentation as to what their vision for the state is. And you could kind of objectively say that with the exception of the statutory changes, which the governor has said he believes and his legal team have said are completely illegal, and there's no way that you can get those through, and that even if you were to approve those, you would be tied up in lawsuits for multiple years before anything could even be realized.
I think that's fair to say, no matter what.
Right,
yeah, but
right.
Anyway, yeah.
So let's get out there. But then the rest of the budget, and we always talk about structural change. It was basically same old. Let's make sure the municipalities can keep spending. Let's make sure we do ECS the exact same way. Let's make sure we keep spending the same amount of money and all this other stuff. And we're still at square one as to where we were on June 30th. The Speaker of the House was in attendance. He said, hey, these are some good ideas, but there also see some bad ideas. And it looks like this July 18th day that they were supposed to vote on a budget.
And this is, and just so I understand, this is a deadline, but not like a hard deadline.
Yeah, right. It's not a hard deadline. It was a day that kind of was that came out of the blue, that the Speaker of the House said, we're going to vote on July 18th.
We already did hard deadlines.
Didn't take so much.
And it appears we're nowhere near that. You know, we're a week away from that, and it appears there's no real gumption at all to get anything done by July 18th. The real deadline, I know Keith's talked about it, is as we approach September. And the reason there is because that's when school funding goes out to cities and towns. That's when municipal aid funding goes out. Right now, the suffering is with those nonprofit groups, which you guys have done a ton of reporting on. But in September is when average Joe, Jennifer on the street, all these people are going to see, oh, wait a minute, we don't have a public works department with as much money as they used to have, things like that.
Susan?
Yeah, really nothing has happened, and that is so disappointing. And there's not even, it doesn't seem like there's even any appetite for passing what the governor called a mini budget, that they want to just rely on executive orders to run the state, which is a really awful way to run the state, because there's just, there's only so much the governor can do. And I saw the Republicans' proposal, and they want to do something like Rhode Island did with regard to changing the statutes to actually change labor agreements. In Connecticut, we can't really do that. I don't believe that there's contracts instead of statutes or something like that. In Rhode Island, they actually just did everything with statutes, so they could change them.
And they had lawsuits anyway.
They sure did. But yeah, so that seems like a non-starter. But this is the kind of thing that I think we may see from Republicans should they ever actually win control of the legislature, and should they actually elect a governor, these are the kinds of battles we might see in the future.
Well, and the other piece of this too is that which really can't be lost. The Democrats don't have the votes they used to have. Themyscira keeps talking about that, but that is a very big mathematical problem. The Democrats can lose only so many votes in the House. They can lose zero votes in the Senate, and then have Nancy Wyman break the tie. If this was, in fact, 5 years ago, we would have had a budget already. We might be back in the same fiscal spot eventually anyway. But the Democrats are trying to make sure that there are as many fingerprints on this as possible to ensure a little bit of political protection, which is extremely callous and pessimistic. But that's the fact of what's going on right now.
Colin.
They should do a mini budget. I mean, that's the short answer to this question. It's a short budget, too. But they should do a mini budget to stop the bleeding, to at least put some of these vulnerable groups on some kind of footing so they know a little bit about what's going to happen week to week. I mean, they should just pass the mini budget. No matter what they think of it, they should do that. That's sort of like a moral thing to do right now. And then they should go have their heads examined and so they can figure out what's wrong with them that they can't.
But they can't go to one of the nonprofit community providers because they don't have any money to do it.
No, but that, you know, most of them have really good state health plans. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. We need a short-term solution to a long-term problem, and the long-term solutions do involve all kinds of things, including maybe stuff that, you know, you wind up in court for a couple of years and you come out of it with a different kind of picture.
And I don't mean to chime in again, but I had a conversation with one of the people who runs multiple nonprofits in the state, and they said to me, I'm going to leave them nameless for the sake of retribution, etc. They said, Max, I don't think the people in the House of Representatives understand the consequences of what they're not doing. He said, I don't think they get it. The notion of not spending money for all these different nonprofit groups, he said, they obviously don't understand what's happening here. Whereas up in the Senate, they're saying, let's pass the mini budget. We need to send out the money. The governor is saying, let's send out the money. And in the House, it's just this jumbled mess and nobody can agree on that.
Okay, so a jumbled mess. Nobody can agree on it. We've already actually said the words. What's wrong with them? Well, you know, the Atlantic lined up behind a whole bunch of other pieces that have been written kind of like this over the course of the last couple of years and asked the question, what on earth is wrong with Connecticut? Amongst the things written, despite being the richest state in the country by per capita income, Connecticut's budget is a mess. Its pensions are woefully underfunded. Its deficit is projected to surpass $2 billion or 12% of its total annual tax revenue. Hartford approaching bankruptcy, et cetera, et cetera. The author, Derek Thompson, goes on to outline a few other things that he thinks is wrong with the state. Let's listen to him talking with WNPR's Ray Hardman earlier this week.
One thing that's often missed about Connecticut is the simple out-migration rate. The number of people that are leaving Connecticut is really extraordinarily high. It's rare for a state to shrink, particularly a rich state, but Connecticut's population has indeed been shrinking for the last few years, and I think in many ways this comes down to the fact that although it does have many corporations, it's not a place where young college graduates typically want to cluster unless they absolutely have to work in Stamford for a hedge fund or private equity firm. And as a result, its cities and its near city suburbs, I think, have trouble attracting young talent, and that has a feedback loop where it discourages corporations from wanting to stay there. And I think that right now the fiscal situation that we're seeing, the crisis that we're seeing, is very much a result of a failure of the state to attract young talent, to attract new families.
Colin, perhaps, and that's again Derek Thompson from The Atlantic, who wrote this piece, What on Earth is Wrong with Connecticut, that we wanted to spend some time talking about. Before we get to some of the details that he outlines, some of the very things that we talk about over and over again on this particular show that are wrong with Connecticut's budget or perhaps people leaving the state, talk about the theme that comes up once again. Obviously, those of us who live here and love living here kind of look at the outsider Atlantic writing about us and going, hey, we can complain about our family, but you can't complain about our family. But, I mean, what did you take away from this piece?
I don't think there's much in the piece that hasn't been part of our public conversation here for the last 2 or 3 years. I may be new news to people who read The Atlantic and live elsewhere, but I don't think there's a lot of new news to us. I do also feel, I mean, Derek Thompson's a really good journalist. I think sometimes there's a little bit of logical fallacy. You look at sort of this Gordian knot of problems, and there's no question that it exists, and you go, well, that thing is causing that thing. So you just heard him say that the failure to attract young families is the reason that we have the public fiscal crisis in our government. I'm not really sure that would hold up to a lot of rigorous economic analysis. I mean, Connecticut has a bunch of problems, some of which are interrelated, some of which are a little bit separate from one another. I don't know. As you know, I was sort of moving in a different direction over the last week, which is that these are all real problems, and I don't deny their existence, but Connecticut has a kind of sourpuss mentality anyway. In the best of times, people walk around complaining about this place. And I was talking to some people who are sort of people who've moved here, you know, people who moved here and bought houses here and put down some roots here, who they were saying, what is with the Connecticut attitude? Like, people just talk about this place like it's so terrible. And look, Connecticut, I mean, people don't move somewhere because the budget either balances or is. I mean, nobody's going to say, wow, I think I'm going to move to that state where the budget is balanced because I'd like to be there. People live in places for other reasons. And I do think we should start with the notion that this is a good place. This is a place with many attributes. This is a place many people would choose to live in. And then say, yes, we have a whole bunch of problems that need to be addressed. Some of them are connected to one another. But I think there's like a snowball effect or a gloom ball effect. You know, this thing starts rolling downhill. And after a while, you start thinking like you live in Syria or something. You know, I mean, we have problems, but they're not fatal problems. Connecticut's going to be fine.
Yeah, and that's a question of whether or not the constant doom and gloom, especially in the business sector, actually has a tangible effect. If businesses think that this place is so, so, so bad off, that makes them not want to stay here and makes them not want to invest here. So this kind of morale problem that Connecticut has, and it has had for a long time, it really does, I think, it has something tangible. The thing that I found interesting in the article, that, and this is something we talked about, that Connecticut doesn't have a tax. It said, this is what the article said, that it doesn't have a tax problem or a revenue problem or a spending problem. It has a city problem. That was an interesting point. It's something that we've all talked about here, that we don't have a big city. And that's why, say, Aetna is leaving because they wanted to go to a big city. It's why GE left Fairfield to go to Boston, a big city. Certainly that's not the entire problem, but it is a small piece of the larger problem that we don't have a big, robust city that has a lot of the amenities that maybe young people want to have. And can we have that? I don't know.
I think Colin brings up a great point that if you're from Connecticut, there is a kind of a bitterness for some reason. I definitely caught it. My wife hears it. Like, when we moved up here, Kelly goes, why is everyone so angry all the time? Like, what's the deal? And she and some of her coworkers who weren't from Connecticut all said, we really like living here. This is really nice. Like, the schools are really good. The roads are paved, relatively speaking. You know, it's a nice place to live. And the interesting thing is, and a lot of the negativity does kind of curl back to the budget and the quality of the way the fiscal situation is being handled. You know, if the pensions in this state were actually funded, even at a low level, we can keep paying for all the things this state wants to pay for, which are expensive things: great schools, great roads, good infrastructure, you know, good public services. And I feel like the Atlantic article, even though it's not the New York Times, it's not the LA Times, not the Washington Post, it's a widely subscribed publication. It's like the dirty little secret about Connecticut's problems is now no longer a secret. People around the country are saying, what is going on with that state that I grew up knowing was kind of what I thought was a wonderful place to live?
Well, if part of the problem that I think a few of us have outlined already is that the people who do live here and do invest here have a constantly negative attitude about it, what effect does that have? Earlier this week, Lucy Nalpathanchil sat down with Oz Griebel. He's the outgoing head of the Metro Hartford Alliance. Of course, the Metro Hartford Alliance works with businesses. It's trying to make a small city a larger region. And here's his thought on some of the negativity.
I do want to keep emphasizing that this is always a balancing act and making sure that we don't let the negativity overwhelm us. At the same time, you don't want to put your head in the sand and pretend that there aren't issues. But we are in a very strong position in this state. The foundation of our assets is strong. They're under attack, like they are in many other states. We're not unique in the fiscal challenges that we're facing. The city of Hartford's not unique in the fiscal challenges it's facing. Greater collaboration among all of us, whether they're organizations or individuals, greater collaboration, sustained collaboration between the private sector and the public sector is absolutely critical.
And one of the things Oz is saying there, Colin, is we're not the only ones who are having problems just like this. And we've outlined those in the past. There are a lot of states that are underwater in their state budgets.
Right. So, first of all, Oz, in many, at least rhetorically, Oz is kind of the best of his species, you know, and what you hear from Oz is kind of what I'd like to hear more from business leaders. If you listen to some of the pronouncements that have come out of CBIA over the last 3 or 4 years, I mean, they really sound like they're trying to say you shouldn't come here and try to do business, not under the current situation. I put up this Facebook post that basically said what I just said before, that this is basically a good place to live, and people should at least acknowledge that there are more things that they like about Connecticut than things that they hate about Connecticut. And can we also agree that there are more, you know, to Max's point, more sources of abundance and ways that our needs and wants are met than there are lacks? And it got like 1,600 likes, which is sort of a lot on Facebook. The people who differed with me, and they were over on Twitter, like one guy who really went after me, I'm not going to say his name, but he's the leader of one of Connecticut's biggest banks. He's the Connecticut regional president of a very significant bank. And he came right back at me and said, Connecticut has a fiscal cancer. And I wrote back to him, I said, you know, the spirit of this post was not to deny, I acknowledged in the post that we have problems, but can we at least acknowledge also that this is a good place? And he would not let up. His message is, this place has cancer, and unless we get chemo and some kind of radical organ removal, we're all going
to
die.
Because the thing you're supposed to do when somebody has cancer is sit there and yell at them and say, you suck, why do you have cancer?
And this guy, this guy is a business.
They do that at Sloan Kettering, I think, now, don't they? That's right.
This guy is a business thought leader. And as I think I said in the emails, really, you know, if CBIA and some of these other business people, if they'd been the Chamber of Commerce in Amity, all they would have talked about was the shark. They would have said, don't come to this island where there are so many sharks. Don't go in the water. Cancel 4th of July. Too many sharks. Don't come here.
A point about CBIA and the negativity about Connecticut. It's an interesting thing. I heard someone speak at a kind of a convention thing a couple years ago of southern states talking about southern economic development. And what he said was, yes, we're a low-cost region, right? We are the cheapest place to do business in this country. But he also said, if you don't have good schools, I can't get you development. If you don't have good hospitals, I can't get you any jobs. Connecticut has those two things. And, you know, if everything was, in fact, about the cheap cost of doing business and everything, Mississippi would be going through this incredible renaissance right now, and the same with Alabama and Georgia.
Well, and I've mentioned this before on the program, Susan, you know, we lost a whole bunch of jobs, a whole bunch of young people to, say, the state of North Carolina. And North Carolina, in fact, does have that more lax regulatory environment and lower taxes, and they try to bring people there. But then within the last couple of years, something unusual has happened. North Carolina has begun to lose a lot of businesses because of their very non-progressive views towards, say, gay and lesbian people. Some of the laws that have been passed, they've actually chased out the NCAA and big corporations because they're not what Connecticut is. They're not a progressive state that looks at all people and say, come on in, you're welcome.
Right, exactly. And I talk to people all around the country who we're from here. There is sort of this big Connecticut diaspora of people who left the state.
Small state, big diaspora.
I know, right? No, there's people who leave and don't come back, or who, you know, because they migrate somewhere else. Like all the people that I knew in high school and college, a lot of them left. They went to get like tech jobs somewhere else. They go to California, they go to Boston, they go somewhere else. But I talk to them, and there's a lot that they actually miss about Connecticut. They get down in the States sometimes too, but there's also just a lot that they miss. They miss the weather in the fall. They miss nice things to do. They miss the quality of life here. They miss the good schools. So they miss a lot of the really positive things. And I wonder, how in the world can we get these people who do miss the state, how can we get them to come back?
A last thought, Colin?
No, I think we've summed it up here pretty well. I mean, I don't want to suggest for a moment that we don't need to address these problems. And some of the problems, I think this will bleed well into what I think we're going to be talking about in the next segment, because the 2018 election will be about a lot of these things. But I would hope that I would hope that underlying that is some kind of confidence here that just because Mark Bertolini wants to, you know, drink expensive scotch in Chelsea, you know, that doesn't mean that's not a reflection on what we have. We need to work on putting some of these problems behind us. I'll just quickly say, you know, the one story we haven't mentioned here so far is the degradation of Hartford's bond rating to junk bonds, which is some of the bad news of today. But I know that what Luke Bronin wants to do is work as hard as possible to put this fiscal stuff behind us, so that we actually can be some of the things a city like Hartford can be. At a time when people are being priced, young people, the people that we're talking about right now, the people in their 20s, the creative class, they're being priced out of some of the places they did want to live. You know, if we do things right, we could really attract them to some of our cities.
Colin McEnroe hosts The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Max Reese is a political reporter for NBC Connecticut. And Susan Bigelow is a columnist for CTNewsJunkie.com. What Colin's talking about is, well, there's some money numbers out for the gubernatorial candidates. Are going to find out how they're shaking out the money tree. We'll find out next in The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Max Reese from NBC Connecticut, Susan Bigelow, who writes for CTNewsJunkie.com, and Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Well, we'd mentioned the 2018 gubernatorial election. I think with all the things we've talked about so far throughout the program, Colin, there is a question, who exactly would want the job of the next governor of the state of Connecticut? But it turns out that a lot of people do. And we've got some new money numbers, how much money they've raised, and in an important piece of this, Colin, how much money they've raised to qualify for state financing as well, which is, I think, going to be the thing that's going to allow a couple more people into the race.
Right. So when you read articles about this, at least for now, you want to look at people who are not exploratory, but who are candidates and who are therefore living under the restrictions of the citizen election program. I mean, this is the big bar you have to clear. You have to raise that $250,000 in these small amounts, and they all have to be qualifying. They have to be in state and stuff like that. So, I mean, there are people who've raised a lot of money, but to my eyes, it doesn't look like it's qualifying money. And if you don't get there, you're probably not going to get very far into the 2018 campaign. So, I mean, at the moment, I mean, there are some people who seem to be doing that very well. But, like, for example, the Connecticut Mirror has a very nice chart of this, but I would advise you to go down the column that explains the status of each campaign. Because if you're raising exploratory, then you don't have to live within these limits. I guess that was a very wonky in the weeds kind of thing. But really, you have to qualify for anyway for the matching funds or you can't get very far.
Oh, no, go ahead. Sorry, no, but to that point, that's what makes raising money in Connecticut for the Citizens Elections Program so interesting. If you're a candidate and you're offered $100,000 for your campaign, which would be by a bunch of limits, you want that money, right? But that doesn't get you closer to the $2 million you might qualify for that taxpayers would pay for. So that's the balance. If somebody wants to give you $1,000, say, well, can you really only give me $100 actually, and then just save that for when I get there? But there's no guarantee you're going to get
it. Give it to State Central and they'll get it to me somehow.
Yeah.
No, just kidding about that.
Didn't mean that at all.
It's a joke.
And please don't put that in an email chain, Susan.
Of course, there's the question of whether or not the Citizens Elections Program is going to survive the budget process. So Who knows? But yeah, it does make things very interesting, and it does highlight a couple candidates who seem pretty strong.
Well, and I want to talk about those candidates in a second, but let me just back up quickly to the thing that you just said. I mean, is there a possibility of that? We've been talking about this before. Raiding the Citizens Election Fund has been part of the last couple budget crises that we've had. Well, now we're operating without a budget. Is there a chance that this just goes away?
It's possible. It's also possible that it will get axed as part of a budget deal. Who knows? That's been part of the discussions. I know that some people have floated that idea.
I mean, something that we've talked about a lot, Max, is that while many in the GOP might be constitutionally opposed to the idea that this is a good thing, this has also allowed the GOP basically to draw even in the Senate. I mean, without the state money, you wouldn't have the type of competitive races that you had.
Democrats have a much bigger, a robust financing base, campaign financing base. Republicans helicopter into Connecticut for national races. Those local races for a state house and Senate just don't get the money. So you might be kind of a careful what you wish for proposition here if you get rid of the Citizens Elections Program. But at the end of the day, which what Susan's alluding to and you're alluding to, there's a big pot of money sitting right there that only gets used for elections. If you could send that money to other programs, I think a lot of taxpayers wouldn't necessarily object.
We just have 5 minutes left, Colin. I'm wondering if you might take a look at some of the names, whether it's State Controller Kevin Lembo, who we've known is going to stage a run at the top of the Democratic field as far as money raising, or Prashad Srinivasan on the GOP side, who's raised more money than anybody else.
Right. So, and he's raised, he says anyway, I get his emails, qualifying contributions in the amount of $205,000. So he's, you know, he's running down the home stretch here. He's clearly going to make it. He's certainly not a name that's particularly well known to Connecticut voters. So that may be a huge problem. Mark Loretti also is the mayor of Shelton. If you told me to drive to Shelton right now, I would have to probably ask Siri for some help. But it does exist somewhere. There's
go west.
Shelton. Yeah. And, but I mean, he's mayor of Shelton. He's raised, I think, about $143,000. That's a lot of money in qualifying contributions, too. He's had in the ring. He's operating under the program. So these are not well-known names at all. You know, Mayor of Shelton is not like Thane of Cawdor, even. You know, it's like you're not destined to grip for
that's
greatness.
That's near Killingly, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. It's early. These people have to establish themselves. I think Boughton is from Danbury, probably still a little bit of the kind of thought leader, front runner. But he's got a problem, too, which is like he's talking about getting rid of the income tax, but I mean, I could talk about doing that, too. I mean,
there's lots that we could talk about doing.
It's interesting that Chris Matty collected so much money. That's fascinating. I mean, this is a guy who has to boost his name recognition.
We should say, running as a Democrat, former U.S. attorney.
Yeah, former U.S. attorney, put Roland away round two. You know, he's born and raised in, I believe, Windsor, Connecticut.
Yep.
You know, he's and then also, by the way, just got a boost from the Boston Globe. This is not to be disrespectful, Chris Matty, but the Boston Globe is writing a column about a person running for governor in Connecticut who most people can't name. So that kind of gives you an idea of how he's viewed outside the state.
A quick thought, Susan?
Well, Matty is interesting because progressives are starting to really get interested in him. The left wing of the Democratic Party, they're sort of for Lembo. They like him. But it really seems like they're giving Matty a shot. And he's got a smart fundraising arm going on. He's been able to raise a lot of money. He's obviously pretty skilled at getting his name out there and getting those liberal voters interested in him.
I have to just say, Colin, and I don't know if I'm reading too much into this, but as I look down this list, $143,000 to Kevin Lembo, Chris Matty raised $118,000, Dan Drew has raised $177,000, and we go down. All these people we've mentioned and several more have all raised over $100,000. We spent a lot of this program talking about how people are down on politics and politicians. We've spent a lot of time talking about how Connecticut is in this state of permanent fiscal crisis. Boy, that's an awful lot of money that people seem to be giving to people to run campaigns to probably lose and not become the next governor of Connecticut. I don't know. Is this money well spent?
Well, the ones that are at least operating within the CEP, the matching fund system, they're getting them in amounts ranging from $5 to $100. So that's a pretty cheap date. And a lot of times you're being prevailed upon by somebody you know. Please come to this thing. Give this money because we're going to have this thing. And, you know, it's $25, $30, $50. People don't go nuts over that.
But if people are so down on the system, if people don't believe in politicians and their ability to change anything about the lot of their lives, do they even really want to give $25 $5 and show up at a chicken dinner.
Well, run your eye down that list and look at how many people can be identified either as outsider candidates or people who are not prominently identified with the system. It's most of them, really. I mean, one reason there's a whole bunch of mayors in there, obscure state legislators, a U.S. attorney who's absolute, former U.S. attorney who's absolutely running as an outsider. I mean, everybody's going to run as an outsider. Even insiders can run as outsiders. Nobody wants to be an insider right now. So that's maybe that answers your question. Most of these people are saying, I am going to come and dismantle this system you hate so much.
And on a financial level, this is a wide open race. Nobody has any clue who the next governor of the state is going to be in the next 18 months.
Max Reese is a political reporter for NBC Connecticut. Thank you, Max.
Always a pleasure, John.
Susan Bigelow is a columnist for CTNewsJunkie.com. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you.
And thanks to our own Colin McEnroe. Thank you, Colin.
I know it's not going to be Joe Visconti.
You just had to throw that in, didn't you?
Well, Max said we didn't know. So.
Our technical producer is Kyone Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brand. And the executive producer of The Wheelhouse is Katie Talarski. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm John Dankosky.
This is WNPR.